appreciate you being patient with being very teachy through these verses, but I want us to learn what the Bible says, and I don't know how else to do it other than this. So hopefully the Lord will touch your heart. Verse 30, chapter 10, verse 30, he's talked about the sparrows and how there's not one sparrow that falls and without the Father, which means not just that he knows about it, but he is the one that allows it to happen. I heard a preacher say he's attended every funeral of every sparrow, and I believe that. We're talking about Matthew. He's writing the book to the Jews, primarily to the Jews, certainly to all the world, but especially to the Jews, and talking about the kingdom. He's talking about the Messiah, talking about the king. Unfortunately, the Jews did not accept their Messiah. The kingdom has been postponed. But Matthew's writing to these people, trying to get them to understand the one you've been waiting for is standing right before you. This is him. And they didn't believe it. But in verse 30, but the very hairs of your head are numbered. He's saying here, God knows everything about you. Now, I didn't used to say it just like this, but to tell you the truth, I don't care how many hairs on my head I have. I'm getting a little bit more concerned about that now than I used to. But it really does not matter. I could not care less, but God knows. He knows everything about us. He knows the problems you're going through. He knows the difficulties you face. He knows the issues you have. He knows your background. He knows where you came from, what you've gone through. He knows it all, and I'm glad that he knows how to help us all. So simply saying he knows everything about us, I'll say it like this. There isn't anything he doesn't know. There isn't anything God doesn't know about us. That can be a blessing, but it also can be kind of scary because he does know everything about us. Some things I wish he didn't. Then in verse 30 again, the sparrows, fear ye not, therefore, for ye are of more value than many sparrows. This is the third time in this chapter that the Lord has says, fear not. He said in verse 26, 28, and now this verse, fear not. I believe he wants us to not be afraid. It's amazing to me some of the times that the Lord tells his people to not fear in times of difficulty, in times of danger, in times of desperation, but he still says, fear not. He wants us to not fear. And the reason is because he wants us to trust him. He says, you're worth more than many sparrows. And if there's not one sparrow that dies without him, not only again knowing it, but allowing it, if he is that much in control of a bird, he surely is in control of our lives. It's important to remember that. Important also to remember when Jesus is saying this to the disciples. He is about to send them out into the world to preach the gospel of the kingdom. He is about to send them out on their solo flight, if you will. And they're going into a world most of the people don't want to hear it. They're going into the world, and Jesus has already warned them, you will be persecuted. And he's sending them out two by two. He's sending them out to preach the gospel of the kingdom. And he is saying this when he is about to send them out. He's saying, don't you worry, if your Father takes care of the sparrows and knows about them and knows what they're going through, he's going to take care of you, even though you will be persecuted and even though people will not accept. He said, there's going to be some that will accept. There's going to be multitudes that will believe. He's saying, the Lord, the Father, is not going to let anything happen to you that he doesn't have a purpose in. Boy, what a blessing. That's true of us today. We need to realize that, remember that, when we're struggling, when we're going through things we do not understand and wish that we're not going on, we need to remember that our Father has his hand on it. And he has either caused it, literally, himself, directly, or he has allowed it for some reason. Jesus said, you just don't have to worry. Verse 32. Whosoever therefore shall confess me before men, him will I confess also before my Father which is in heaven. The word confess here, we probably have a thought about what it means. But in 1 Timothy 6:12, Paul writes, has professed a good profession before many witnesses. That's the same Greek word as confess. It means to publicly proclaim that we have believed on the Lord. It is a public demonstration, a public confirmation. It is using our words to say, I have believed on Him. And He says, the person who confesses Me before men, I will confess also before My Father which is in heaven. He's saying, if you tell people you know Me, when you stand before the Father, I'll tell Him, I know you. And we think, well, why would that even be necessary? Well, He's just confirming the fact that if you stand up for Me now, I'll stand up for you later. And by the way, if we ever, we need Him to stand up for us now. We need Him desperately now to say, that's one of mine. I'm going to take care of one of mine, no matter what they're going through. But nothing like when we stand before God. Boy, we'll need somebody to take up for us then. Now, I don't know if Jesus will literally say the words, but in essence, He's saying, that's one of mine. Let him in. And we find that certainly where He says, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Enter thou into the joy of the Lord. He is saying, that's one of mine. If you confess Me on earth before Me, and I'll confess you when you stand before the Father. And there's a lot of people who say they're saved, but they're not. It's not genuine. It's not real. He's talking here about something that is real. And I thought about this. Jesus makes it very clear that how we respond to Him will determine where we spend eternity. He doesn't beat around the bush. He doesn't hint. He doesn't make a subtle suggestion. He says, how you respond to Me will determine whether you go to heaven or to hell. Talked to a Muslim not long ago, and he said, I don't think Muslims and Christianity have much difference. I think they're a lot alike. And I thought, are you out of your mind? Jesus said, I am the only way, the only way. And that's what He's saying here. If you want Me to confess you before My Father, you better confess Me before men. In other words, be saved and know it. Verse 33, but whosoever shall deny Me before men, him will I also deny before My Father, which is in heaven. I said again, many claim to be saved, but they've never called on the Lord. They never have made an open profession with their lips that they have believed on the Lord. A lot of people are going to heaven. But if you ask them, why do you think they're going to heaven? They'll say everything under the sun. Well, I'm a pretty good person. I do the best I can. I follow the golden rule. I think I do better, more good than bad. But the only way to get to heaven is by the blood of Christ. And Jesus said, if you deny Me, in other words, if you use any other reasoning or any other excuse to say you're going to go to heaven but Me, when you stand before the Father, I'll say, I don't know you. Yeah, that's the saddest words in the Bible. Depart from Me, ye worker of iniquity. I never knew you. That's exactly what He'll say to a person who says, that does not claim Him on earth. When they stand before God, and they all will, we all will, He won't claim us then. Look in verse 34. Think not am I come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. Well, they had mixed emotions with this statement, I'm sure, because they thought He had come to overthrow Rome. That talks about a sword and fighting and war and battle. But they also thought He was coming to overthrow Rome in order to bring peace, to fight for peace and to win it and set up a kingdom of peace. But He said, don't think that I've come to bring peace. I have come to bring a sword. And he more or less stops there. And He's talking, of course, about the division. His message, listen, was a message of peace. but it caused war. It caused division. Why? Because some people didn't believe it. Some people said, I can't accept that. I don't believe you're the one. You're not coming like I thought you should. Everything I've believed all my life, you're not portraying that. So a message of peace became a message of division because they would not accept it. And that's how it is today. There's still division because people will not accept what he said. He was and is the Prince of Peace, but the effects of him coming caused division. Because some said, I just can't believe that. I just won't believe that. He talked about bringing a sword. He comes with a sword. That sword means disagreement or fighting or opposition. It means, again, the word division or discord. This had to confuse the disciples because, again, they thought, here comes the Messiah, or the Messiah that we believe in will come with a hand of might, and he'll overthrow Rome, and he'll set the people of Israel free, and he'll set up the kingdom, and everything will be fine. And that's not what this Jesus is saying. But one thing for sure, I'll say this and move on. God has not forgotten his promise. It was the Jews that rejected the Messiah. It was the Jews that rejected the kingdom. And had God not been God, he could have just said, okay, you don't want me? Poof. I won't mess with you. But he did not poof them. He temporarily set them aside. He will keep his promise. One day the kingdom will come. One day the Prince of Peace will come. One day the 1,000-year millennial will be a reality. In Matthew 25, verse 31, when the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit on the throne of his glory. That kingdom, God did not just say, okay, I just forget it. Just forget it. I know I promised it, but forget it. If you don't accept me and my Son, just forget it. You don't deserve it. He said, if you don't accept my Son, I'll turn to the Gentiles, but I'll remember my promise. I'll keep my promise. Look in verse 35. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father. Remember, he said, I didn't come to bring peace. I came to bring a sword. And he continues, I thought I come to set a man at variance with his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and the man's foes shall be they of their own household. He says, this message that I'm coming with will not only divide a nation, it'll divide a family. Where the father will turn against the daughter, or the daughter will turn against the mother, or the mother-in-law against the father, the daughter-in-law. Well, that's, I don't know if that's too big a deal. That's sometimes common anyway. But he said, this message I'm bringing divides. You think I bring peace? Oh, no, I don't bring peace. Now, my message is a message of peace, but it divides. And so it is. You know families where there's one lost and one saved? They may get along generally, and that's a miracle of sorts if they do. But there's still no real connection. There cannot be a connection with darkness and light, gospel and sin. There's a variance, as he says. There's a division. There is a fight. He said, I've come to bring a sword. And sometimes that sword, that battle, is in your family. Because one accepted me and one hasn't. And boy, that's surely even the truth today. Look in verse 37. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Boy, he just speaks directly. He says, you ought to love me more. You ought to love me more than anything or anybody. I don't think that's asking too much. He sure didn't think it was asking too much, and neither do I. He says, you ought to love me more than your own parents. You ought to love me more than your own children. Oh, listen, you ought to love me more than your own grandchildren. He says, Anyone who loves anybody more than me, they're not worthy to call themselves my children. Boy, what a blunt statement that is. How do we know we love somebody? He said, you ought to love me more than anybody, even your own family. Well, how do I know if I love him or not? How do you know if you love anybody? We can measure our love by how we treat those we claim that we love. We can measure our love by how we treat those that we claim we love. Somebody we really love, we want to please them. It pleases us to please somebody if we love them. And that's how it should be with the Lord. We ought to want to please him. If we love him, we'll have a desire to please him. How do we measure if we love somebody and how much we love them? By if it pleases us to please them, if we put them before ourselves, if we love somebody, they come first before anybody or anything. If I love somebody, they come before me. That's one evidence. That's one way I can measure whether I really love them or not. And if I love him, he comes before me. He comes before anybody, but he comes before me. He comes first. If we love him, he controls us instead of anybody, including family. Boy, and he's not saying it's all right to mistreat or abuse or neglect family. The Bible's clear in other places that we're wrong if we do any of that. He's just saying, if you love them or you love me, who you love the most. And he said, if you don't love me more, you're not even worthy of me. Look in verse 38. And he that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. He's about again to send them out. He's getting very specific. And you're going out into a cesspool of sin. You're going out into a world that's going to hate you. And you better make sure you love me if you're going to do that. In verse 38, he says, yeah, there's going to be problems in the world in general, but there's going to really be some problems for you in just a little while. He says, he that taketh not his cross and followeth not after me is not worthy of me. The idea of a criminal who has been found guilty of such a crime that death is the right thing. It is a crime that's sufficient. The word the death penalty is the right thing. And what they did then, they crucified somebody. They did not just crucify them, but the criminal had to carry their cross to the place of execution. And Jesus likens that into our walk with him. Well, that didn't sound too inviting, does it? But it's still, we know it's the truth. And he said that he that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. He's talking about a man who is about to die. And part of his sentence is carrying that cross. Now, you think about that. You think about pain. You think about misery. You think about people attacking you or being vicious. You think about pain and suffering and anguish and ridicule. All those things are involved in carrying a cross. That's a criminal, and he has done something that's worthy of death, and he's getting what he deserves. But the cross means more than all that. It means death. Now, that's really what the cross is all about. All those other things, the pain and anguish and all ridicule, all that's a part of it. But the final result of a cross is dying. And Jesus said, that pain and suffering and anguish and ridicule, that'll be a part of your life that you have to bear. If you're going to be a good disciple, you'll have to bear those, but don't forget the ultimate thing, death. It's a picture of us dying out to self. Of dying to self. Paul said, I die daily. Several times in the New Testament, we have the picture of dying to my desire and dying out to what I want. And one thing for sure, I cannot do God's will and my will at the same time. Can't do it. And dying out to self means I don't care about my will. It's what does he want? And that's a part of the cross that he's talking about here. Dying out to self. Saying, Father, what I want to do today doesn't matter. What do you want me to do? What is your will? What do you desire? That's what dying out to self is. The path of the cross for Jesus was a path of obeying the Lord. From when he left heaven and was born of a virgin, and from the infancy all the way to the crucifixion, all the way to the resurrection, all the way back to the ascension, every bit of it was him surrendering to the Father's will. It was a path of obedience. And what he's saying here is, your Father also has a will for you. He has a path he wants you to follow. And dying out, bearing your cross means I walk the path my Father wants me to walk. And flesh doesn't want that. Flesh doesn't desire that. Flesh will fight that and resist that. One thing for sure Jesus is making crystal clear, those that follow him will suffer. But in spite of all of it, it's still the best path there is. I mean, what better path? Lost people suffer. Lost people do without. Lost people are mistreated. Lost people get everything that we can think of that we get in some degree or other, but they don't get the blessings of the Lord. They don't get the blessings of doing the Father's will. And so Jesus is not saying, I'm sending you out on an easy path. He's saying, I'm sending you on a tough path, but I'm sending you on a path where the blessings are. So it's a better path. Refusing to take our cross simply means I do things the way I want to and not the way the Father wants me to. That's just simply put. Verse 39, he that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it. Every one of us are seeking for something. We may not realize it. There's a world that's seeking for peace and happiness and contentment. And they're out in all these places that some of us know about, these places of sin, these practices of sin, trying to find something to make them happy, and it ends them up being more empty and more unhappy. The more they try, the more unhappy they are, because that they're hoping for and that they're depending on to make them happy ends up making them more empty. So it's a vicious cycle that makes it worse and worse. And Jesus said, those that are finding their life in this world, they're trying to find something to make life worthwhile. And he said, those that are looking for life in this world, in the things of the world, they'll lose life. What's real living cannot be found in the world. What's real life cannot be found anywhere other than the Lord. And that's what he says. He that findeth his life shall lose it. He that loseth his life for my sake shall find it. When somebody realizes this world's not going to satisfy me anyway, I'm giving my life to the Lord. I'm living for his sake, for his glory, for his will. And then you find out what real life is about. I tell you, I looked for years trying to find something to find life. And I ended up a miserable mess. When I got saved, I found out what life is all about. And that's what he's saying. If you're seeking to find life in this world, you're going to lose your entire life. But if you'll give your life to me, you'll find out what real living is all about. I just want to just say here, how full is your life? How empty is your life? Look in verse. Well, let me just say this. We need to all make sure we're saved. I know we're on Wednesday night, and you're the faithful of the faithful. I understand that, but we still need to make sure we're genuinely saved, that we're not living our life for something that'll end in this world. Look in verse 40. He that receiveth you receiveth me. He that receiveth me receiveth him that sent me. That word receiveth has the idea of a homeowner receiving guests. I've told you before, I'm not sure I'd like it, but it's still the way it was. Well, started to say things weren't the same then as they are now. There was crooks and mean people then. But there was a custom that if you had a home or you owned a home or if you lived in a house, if there were travelers that went by that came to your door, you let them in. That's called receiving. You opened your home, you opened your meal, you opened your house, you opened a place to lay down. You were a free hotel. That's the custom of that day. It was real good for travelers. And you learned some people. But he said, he that receiveth you, he said, I'm sending you out. And when somebody, you go to somebody's door and they receive you, they're receiving me. Why? Because they were Christ's messengers. They were not coming in their own name. They were not selling Fuller Brush or vacuum cleaners. They were going in the name of Christ. And when somebody received them, opened their home and their heart, they were not just receiving a man, a disciple, but they were receiving the Lord that disciple represented. He said, if somebody receives you, they receive me. And him that receiveth me, receiveth him that sent me. He said, me and my Father, can I say this and not sound cheap? We're in this together. If they receive you, they're receiving me because you represent me. And if they receive me, they receive my Father because I represent him. And the idea is, first off, is just being a blessing, no doubt. If you were a homeowner, you were the host of somebody coming by, you think about in the desert, you didn't have a car, the best you had was a donkey. You've traveled all day in the heat. You're weary, you're tired, you're thirsty, you're dirty, you don't smell good. And somebody opens their home, what a blessing that would be. I know a little bit about that when we hitchhiked to California. We was gone about 5 weeks. The best thing I remember, we stayed inside, I think, about four nights of that 5 weeks. And when you got somebody who would say, you can stay at my house, man, you better believe it, you enjoyed it. It was a blessing. And I thought, I think I can identify a little bit about these weary travelers and somebody opening their home. But you know, that's not what Jesus is saying. He said, he that receives you, not just a weary traveler, but they receive the message you're preaching. They receive you. They're receiving your message. They're receiving the Christ you represent. He's talking about somebody who's opening their heart, not just their home. He's saying when somebody receives you and the message you represent, boy, what a blessing that is. Look in verse 41. He that receiveth a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. He that receiveth a righteous man in the name of the righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. That's kind of what I hit on just a minute ago. When he's talking about somebody receiving you, opening your home, opening their home, they're not just opening their home, they're opening their heart. He says, he that receiveth a prophet in the name of a prophet. In other words, here's somebody, a prophet comes to their home, and they hear the message, they accept the message, and they realize that's a man of God. There's a man of God at our door. We've got to let him in. We want to let him in. We receive him as a prophet. We receive him as a man of God. Do you hear what that means? First, it means they believe the message. And again, it's not just being nice. It's not just being the custom of letting somebody come in and stay the night. But he said, "You, when they receive you as a prophet, they know who you are. They know your message. And they let you in because you are a man of God. They will receive a man of God's reward. They will receive the type of reward the prophet will receive." And then he goes on, "They that receive a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward." He says, sometimes it'll be a Christian that comes to the door telling about Christ, witnessing, telling about the Messiah. And they're not the preacher, but they're just a Christian that loves the Lord. And the host, the homeowner, opens the door and opens their home and opens their heart. because they know this is somebody who loves the Lord. Again, it's not just a custom. It's not just because, well, this is the right thing to do. It's because they have accepted the message they're teaching and preaching and sharing and witnessing. He says, when somebody does that, just because they know you're a Christian, would say today, they receive the reward of a righteous man. Think about it. Oh, boy, I was wanting to cover more territory tonight. We'll just simplify it, make it our language of today. Here's a preacher going door to door in their time, delivering the message, literally knocking on a door, and someone welcomes him in, believes the message, we would say, get saved, and treats that preacher well for the night. Feeds him a good meal, gives him the best place to lay down, gives him place to clean up, place to rest, takes care of his animals. That homeowner, by doing that, is aiding the preacher to go on down the road and preach another message, witness another time. So they are receiving a part, I guess I can say it this way, a part of his reward, because they are helping him to do what he does for the Lord. It made me think about any of us can do that kind of thing. You may not be a preacher. You may not be a missionary. You may not be a singer. But we can somehow help those by being a part of this church. Specifically, you do that because you give your tithes or offerings, and we're able to help people as far as those that serve the Lord. And he says you will get a reward for it. I thought about how it makes me realize we're so connected. You helping somebody serve the Lord, you become a part of their ministry. What a blessing that is. Look in verse 42 and we'll stop. Whosoever shall give a drink unto them of these little ones, he calls us little ones. Well, he calls those who witness little ones and those that go out and obey him little ones. Drink unto these little ones, ones a cup of cold water only in the name of a disciple. Verily I say unto you, he shall in no wise lose his reward. Again, he says, anybody who gives you a cup of cold water because you are a disciple, they've got a reward that they'll never lose. Now again, it's not because, oh my goodness, here's somebody walking. I know they're thirsty. I'm getting some water. It's not just a general being polite thing. It is because they know you're a man of God or a person of God. You're one of his disciples, and I'm helping you because I know who you are. And he said, you'll not lose your reward. It reminds me of how the smallest of things we get rewards for. I mean, a cup of water. I mean, that's just being polite. But again, it's more than being polite. It's because that person loves God. And I want to do all I can to aid those who love God. And he said, even the almost an insignificant, almost unnoticeable thing, you get a reward for. He won't forget one thing we do for his glory. After this, Jesus starts dealing with how he's being rejected. Things are going to start turning around. Things are going to be changing, and unfortunately, abruptly.